Take a look at these four series of numbers. Who can tell me what is the relationship between each number in the series, or between the series themselves? I didn't expect an answer, actually. It's really difficult to look at numbers in this format and glean any useful information from them. However, if we plot these numbers as a set of scatter diagrams, then the answer jumps out at us. We can see very clearly there is a correlation between X and Y in each series, and if we're given another X, we could, with relative accuracy, predict the next Y, some with greater accuracy than others. We can even see that series 3 and 4 have a couple of outliers that we could either decide to throw away as bad data or maybe investigate further, find out why we're getting different information for those points than for the rest of them. The point is that very often, numbers shown as pictures provides a lot more information a lot more quickly than just the raw numbers themselves. And the more numbers you have, the more true that tends to be. Now, I'm a software developer by trade, and a lot of what I do is presenting data to users. And sometimes a picture is a great way to do that. And I've got a lot of great tools at my disposal. This talk is not about tools. This is about getting you to think about what good data visualization is when you're using those tools. But the tools themselves are pretty simple. SQL Server Reporting Services, Microsoft Excel, Crystal Reports. They're all good tools. You select a template to display your data. You select some data source. You click next, next, finish, and bang, you have a pie chart. But what if that pie chart is not the best way to display the data you want to show? Or a more fundamental question is, what do I mean when I say best way to display data? This is something that a lot of developers don't think about. They click next, next, finish, they have something to show the user, and then they're on to the next problem. And so my goal today, over the next 70 minutes or so, is to get you to think about that, to pause after you click next, next, finish, and say, you know, what is this the best way to display data? Can I improve this data visualization? So data visualization, this process of turning numbers into pictures, is something I want you to think about more. Now, one man that's been thinking about this a lot is Dr. Edward Tufte. Dr. Tufte is a professor at Yale University, and for the last few decades, he's been writing about data visualizations. Much of the material you'll see today was ideas borrowed from his writings, a lot of it from this book, The Visual Display of Quantitative Information. And when Dr. Tufte first started studying data visualization, he started by looking at pictures of data that spoke to him, that were really effective at communicating messages to him. And not all of those were computer-generated pictures. This one, for example, is from the 19th century. It's a train schedule. If you look along the top, you'll see the times of the day. It starts at 6 a.m., goes to noon, midnight, and back to 6 a.m., 24 hours along the top. And along the left side is the train stations in France. And these diagonal lines that you see, these diagonal line segments, represent the routes that a train takes from one station to the next. The left end point of each line segment is the date and time of a departure, and the right end point of a line segment is the date and time of a, location and time of a destination. So we can follow one of these routes, for example, this one, and see that there is a train that leaves Paris at 12:20 in the afternoon, and it arrives in Tonnerre at 6:30 in the evening. It's pretty straightforward. It's very simple, not difficult to read. One could argue that the airline schedule makers could learn something from this chart. Here's another good chart, also from the 19th century. This is the reason that I like this one is because it shows several series of data along the same axis. And because they're along the same axis, we can compare them. We can see if there's any correlation between these data. And if there's correlation, maybe we can come up with a hypothesis as to why that correlation exists. The red line at the bottom of this is the average wage paid to a mechanic in England during each one of these decades, between the mid-16th century and the mid-19th century. The bar chart in the middle is the average price of a bushel of wheat during that same time period. And you can see that The price of wheat and labor wages, they kind of follow the same path, although the price of wheat is much more volatile than wages. And an answer to why that's true might lie in the third series at the very top of this picture, which shows who were the reigning monarchs during each of these periods, or more likely, what wars were being waged by those monarchs. But we can start to ask those questions because we see everything along the same axis here. In this case, it's time. This is geographic data. This is a lot of geographic data. This is from the 1960 census. And of course, maps are great for displaying geographic data. But census data is a lot of points, millions of data points. This is broken out by county. Every one of these lines is either a county or a parish or some county-like entity in the U.S. So even in aggregation, there's still over 3,000 of these county-like entities in the U.S. This shows the percentage of the number of high-income families and low-income families in each county. The green graph at the bottom are the high-income families, the red graph at the top are the low-income families, and darker shaded counties represent a higher concentration. Lower shade counties represent a lower concentration. So you can see that darker shades of red in the top graph tell me that in South Texas, in the southeastern United States, there were a lot of poor families in 1960. There were a lot of richer county, higher income families in California at that same time. I can look at the state of Michigan. I'm actually from southeastern Michigan, right there. And if you look at the state of Michigan, you can see that Michigan was doing pretty well. At least southeastern Michigan was doing pretty well in 1960. That map actually might look very different for that part of the country if it were drawn today. I can also see counties in Alaska that have a high percentage of high-income families and a high percentage of low-income families in the same county. Seems like there's no middle class in those counties. So it leads to more questions. There's a lot of information that I can get very quickly. I really like the fact that this is using shades of color rather than distinct colors to indicate high concentration versus low concentration. Our mind thinks very well, can very easily translate a progression of shades, whereas we can't really easily translate this red is low and green is high or something like that. We don't have to think about it. We know dark light. It just makes sense to us. And then there's this graph. This is, Edward Tufte called this the greatest data visualization ever created. This was created by a man named Charles Menard. It's also from the 19th century. And this is actually a map that represents the Emperor Napoleon's advance on and retreat from Moscow near the end of the Napoleonic Wars. On the far western edge of this map is the Russian-Polish border. And on the far eastern edge is the city of Moscow. Notice these broad, jagged lines that go across the map in the middle. One of them is tan, and the one below it is black. Those represent the route that Napoleon and his men took as they marched eastward toward Moscow, that's the tan line, and westward away from Moscow, the black line below it. The thickness of those two lines is proportional to the number of troops at each point. Knowing just that, you can look at this map and very quickly see that this campaign was a disaster for Napoleon. Napoleon entered Russia with almost 500,000 men, expecting to overcome his enemy with superior numbers and live off the land, which is what he had done when he conquered the rest of Europe. But the Russians did not engage him directly in battle. Instead, they retreated. And as they retreated, they destroyed their livestock and their farms and their homes and their towns. They burned everything. And the scorched earth that they left in their path stretched Napoleon's supply lines so thin that he lost far more men to disease, starvation, desertion, and suicide than he ever did Russian bullets. That 500,000 men, by the time they got to Moscow a few months later, had dwindled to 100,000. And that 80% attrition is very clearly seen by that tan line as it gets narrower and narrower as it heads eastward across the map. The way back was even worse. On the way back, that 100,000 men had dwindled to barely 10,000 when they left Russia. And for a clue as to why that happened, we can look at this line down here at the bottom. Thank you. This line down here at the bottom, which shows us the temperature along during his return trip. And this was a brutally cold winter. Temperatures never rose above freezing. And in fact, at one point, on December 8th, right here, the temperature dropped to negative 30 degrees. Now, that could be negative 30 Fahrenheit, it could be negative 30 Celsius. It doesn't matter. Negative 30 degrees. It was brutally cold. And it resulted in 90% attrition, clearly visible as that black jagged line moves across, westward across the map. We can even see where major points of attrition took place. So I think you can see why Edward Tufte liked this map so much. On a single axis, Charles Menard has managed to show the number of troops, position of troops, direction of movement, time, and temperature. And because these are all on the same axis, we can start to compare them and correlate them and come up with hypotheses as to why these things are correlated. So that's the good. Here's a few things to take away from that section of it. You notice that there's a simplicity to all the pictures that I showed you. They're not cluttered up with a lot of extra stuff. They're relatively easy to understand. In 60 seconds at most, I could explain a graph and you could understand how it worked. This idea of using a common axis for comparison is very powerful. Maps, of course, are good for geographic data. You probably knew that part already, but think about shades versus colors. Shades are a lot better for showing gradations of data and numbers, much better than using colors. So if that's the good, what's the bad? What can you do that's wrong with data visualization? Well, one thing you can do is you can lie to your users. And lying to users can take a lot of forms. Some people will lie deliberately. They have a goal, they have an agenda, and they want to deliberately mislead their users. This is from Fox News. This is a graph of showing the unemployment rate each month during 2011, the year before the last presidential election in the United States. And it looks fine. You see it kind of goes up and down and so on until you look at that last number, that November number, and you realize that it's on the same level is this number here. 8.6 is represented the same level as 9.0. Kind of misleading. It's actually above this number. 8.6 is drawn higher than 8.8. So I said before, it's a lot easier to look at pictures of data than it is to look at the data itself. Most people are only going to look at the pictures, and the picture is misleading. It's lying to us. Here's another example from an annual report of a mining company, now defunct mining company. And it shows net income for five different years, each year represented by this tall bar. Everything looks fine until you look very closely at this first number here and realize that it is a negative number. And that's not at all obvious, because whoever created this visualization decided to represent that negative number as a very tall bar, and they've decided not to label zero above it. So I look at something like this, and it causes me to think that I can't really think of another reason why they would choose to represent this data in this way other than to deliberately mislead the viewer. And the problem with that is that I look at it and I start to question every picture in this document, every number in this document. I start to become distrustful of what they're trying to tell me, which is probably the opposite effect they were trying to achieve by representing the data this way. So I can't prove it, but I think the last couple of examples were deliberately meant to mislead. There are people that they have an agenda, they want to present something the perfect way, or they want their side presented better than the other side. Not all lies are deliberate, though. Sometimes people lie without knowing that they're lying. Here's an example that I don't think is deliberate. It's from the New York Times, relatively reputable news source. This is a visualization trying to show the mandated fuel economy for American automobiles during the 70s and 80s. Little history lesson, the There was an energy crisis in this country in mid-70s. We suddenly realized we should probably stop making and buying these huge energy inefficient cars, and we should start making and selling and buying much more fuel efficient cars. And the US government stepped in and they said, well, car companies, add up the average miles per gallon of every car you sell, divided by the number of cars, and that number should be at or below X. And if not, there'll be some penalties. It was pretty harsh. But the good news for the auto companies was they didn't implement it all at once. They said, all right, in 1978, that number has to be 18 miles per gallon, and by 1985, it will increase to 27.5. That's what this graph is trying to show. That number goes up, 18, 19, 20, 22, and so on. And this picture of a road with its horizontal lines, it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. The real problem with this picture is that although this number goes up from 18 to 27.5, it goes up quite a bit, this line that represents the number goes up a lot more than that. It gets a lot bigger. It is not growing proportionally to the data. Now, one could argue that this picture does show the direction of change. Lines get bigger, numbers get bigger. That's true. So what if the magnitude of change is misrepresented by a little bit? But, I mean, is it a little bit? Is it a lot? In fact, how much is it off? How do we even measure that? Well, this is someplace where Edward Tufte stepped in, and he invented something called the lie factor to measure how much data is lying to us. And the lie factor is simply the size of the effect shown in the graphic divided by the size of the effect in the data. If it's telling the truth, it should be one. They should both grow proportionately. In this particular example, the data from 18 to 27.5 grew by 53%. But those lines representing the data grew by 783%. This is a lie factor of 14.8. So it's not, the magnitude is not off by a little bit, it's off by a lot. This is lying to us 15 times over. And I said before that my opinion is that it wasn't done deliberately, that they didn't have an agenda. I mean, it's okay if people have an agenda. It doesn't bother me. Fox News has an agenda. If they're biased, as long as I recognize that, I'm okay with that. Complaining about Fox News having a bias is like complaining the Daily Show has a bias. They do. Deal with it. Don't worry about it. Just be aware of it. But this is a little bit more subtle. Can anyone think of a reason why, besides just deliberate misleading, why this might be so wrong? I throw that to the audience. Level of difficulty. So it was just too hard to represent it as a... entertaining what? So the level of difficulty obtaining, I don't know that the level of difficulty obtaining gas mileage is relevant here, because this isn't the car companies that are displaying this. This is a newspaper that's doing it, so they don't even have to build cars. The perspective is true. They are trying to draw a picture of a road that's kind of fading off into the horizon, which makes it get bigger as it gets closer, and that's correct. So you're partway there with that, I think, at least in my opinion. My feeling is that what happened here is that the New York Times, like a lot of publications in this country, at one point they stopped worrying as much about the accuracy of the visualization and started worrying more about the prettiness of it. They moved the responsibility of creating this graphic away from the journalists, away from the automotive engineers and the columnists, the people that understood that data, and they moved it to the art department, because they wanted to make this thing pretty, because they figured that you, the audience, wouldn't really read it or look at it unless it was entertaining. I don't agree with that, but I think that happens a lot, at least in this country. I know there's a lot of people from other countries, and maybe that's going on different somewhere else, but that happens a lot here. So my opinion, it was not done deliberately, but it's still a lie. It's still telling an untruth, because nobody stopped to look at this and say, you know what? This implies a different story than reality. Here's the reality. This is actually a representation, an accurate representation of how much those values went up. They went up, but not nearly at the rate of this 15 times widening of the road. Here's another example, also probably not intentional. This is the percentage of doctors dedicated to family practice. There used to be a lot of doctors that were generalists. They would treat your whole family for just anything that ails you. As time goes on, doctors tend to be more specialized today than they used to be. And that's what this graph represents here. 1984, there were 27% of doctors were dedicated to family practice, and in 1990, only 12% were dedicated to family practice. And it's shown by this picture of a doctor who's about twice as tall on the left as the doctor on the right. Because 27% is about twice as much as 12, a little bit more than twice as much as 12. The problem with this visualization is that that doctor is a two-dimensional picture. And in fact, this picture varies by both its height and its width. And the area of a two-dimensional object, as you all learned in ninth grade mathematics, is proportional to both its height and its width. So the size of this doctor on the left is not twice as big as the size of the doctor on the right. It's much, much bigger than that. So in this case, the data change, I'm going from right to left here because it's just easier to work with the numbers, but the data change from right to left is 125%, but those pictures change by 406%. So again, this is lying to us, maybe unintentionally, but still, almost four times over, it's lying to us because they've chose to represent one-dimensional data points as a two-dimensional object. It's not necessarily wrong to use a two-dimensional object. I mean, bar charts are two-dimensional objects, but bar charts, the points, the width of every bar does not vary. In this case, they're varying both the width and the height. The problem is even worse if you choose a three-dimensional object for your data points. So in this case here, they've got actually a three-dimensional barrel, a picture of a barrel, and a gas price representing the price of gas as it goes up. Well, that price of gas did go up quite a bit, 454% between the beginning and the end of this graph. But that barrel, if you took this metaphor that they're presenting to us, the volume of gas that would fit in that barrel increased by 27,000%. As far as I know, that's a record lie factor. Here's a more accurate representation of that data. This one, not only does it show the price going up at a more reasonable rate, but also it shows this is both nominal dollars and real dollars. Real dollars are dollars that are adjusted for inflation. And whenever you're dealing with financial data over an extended period of time, you should always adjust dollars for inflation. It is a more honest representation of it. Here's another one. This is the commissions paid to travel agents by four different airlines during three different periods. And you can see from period one to period two, the commissions went up, and from two to three, they went down. That was true for every single one of these airlines. What's not at all obvious from this is that third period is actually only a six-month period. The other two periods are 12-month periods. Of course it went down. It'd be crazy if it didn't go down. It's only half as long. It's not easy to see whether or not, for some of these airlines, whether it went down proportionally. A much better representation of this would be to either annualize that six-month period or to split up those 12-month periods into two bars. As it stands now, it's almost useless and misleading, probably worse than useless. Another important thing when you're talking about the integrity of your data is context. We can provide a couple of data points to tell a story, but those data points really aren't meaningful unless we provide some context around them. Here's an example. Here's two data points on the number of traffic deaths in Connecticut. One in 1955 and one in 1956. I did omit the zero here, but you can see that traffic deaths in Connecticut did go down during that period, and this period was selected because that was the year that Connecticut decided to start enforcing speed limits very strictly. In the past, they kind of winked an eye at it, but in 1955, that became a serious problem, and they started to address it. So this implies that stricter enforcement did save some lives. But we really can't conclude that just from these two points because we don't know what happened before 1955 or after 1956. The graph could have looked like this. We went over a period of years like this or like this. We're only looking at a small window of time here. And we would draw different conclusions depending upon which one of these graphs was true. In fact, the graph looks like this. Here's the two points we were looking at, and you can see that traffic deaths were increasing in the years prior to 1955, and they went down in 56, and they continued to go down after. This actually is compelling evidence that stricter enforcement of speed limits did save some lives in Connecticut. Even more context you can add to this would be to compare it to the states that are contiguous to Connecticut. And this is deaths per 100,000 because some of the states are much higher population, some are much lower. But here we can see that the other states around Connecticut, the number of traffic deaths after 1956, they either remain steady or they increase. Connecticut is the only New England state that has showed a decrease in traffic deaths. This is a much more compelling argument right here. So here's some takeaways from that last section. Don't lie with your data. Think about this lie factor. And lie factors always talks about the proportional change of your data and the proportional change of your visualization. These should be the same. They should be one. If they're off by a lot more than that, then you've got a problem. You're misleading your customers. Use consistent dimensions. Don't try to use two-dimensional data points to represent one-dimensional data, or three-dimensional, even worse. Use real dollars when you're talking about financial money over time, and provide accurate context, relevant context for your visualizations. Questions so far? Okay. I can't see all the audience so very well, so if you have a question, just shout about. Next thing I want to talk about is Data Inc. Data Inc. is, you probably don't remember this, but there was a time when we used to print our reports on paper, you know? No? Okay, well, anyway, when I was a kid, we would print reports on paper, and we'd use ink would be the stuff that would actually make it show up on the paper. That's the dark part of it. That isn't done much anymore. Typically, the visualizations I do, they're on screen. People just see them on the computer screen, on a web page, or in a print preview, something like that. But we can still think of the dark parts of the report as the ink. The data ink is the part of the ink that directly represents the data. And that's the important part of any visualization, is the part that directly represents the data. Everything else is less important than that. And here's another ratio come up that Edward Tufte came up with. It's called the data ink ratio. It's simply the data ink divided by the total ink. And this is a goal of data visualization. A good goal of effective data visualization is to maximize this number within reason. Of course, the highest it can get is 1.0, in which case all of your data, all of your ink is data ink. But we want to get that as high as we can within reason. And I'll talk about what within reason means in a second. But first, some of you are probably asking yourselves, if data ink is only some of the ink, well, what's the rest of the ink? What else could there be? And the rest of the ink could be redundant data. If you've got the same data point represented multiple times, then only one of those, only part of that ink is actually data ink. The rest of it is redundant. You could have metadata. You could have decorations, or what Tufte called chart junk, stuff that really doesn't help the graph at all. All that is a part of a visualization that may or may not be part of the data ink. Let's talk about redundant data first. Here's a visualization that just shows a single point of data. It's the number 35.9. Let's count how many times that number is represented in this visualization. There is a yellow or a vertical line on the left side of that bar. It's 35.9 units tall. This bar also is 35.9 units tall on the right side. There's a horizontal line across the top. It's 35.9 units from the x-axis. This area in the middle that's shaded is 35.9 units tall. There's a number at the top that's 35.9 units from the x-axis. And of course, the number itself is the number 35.9. So what was that, 6, 7? There's a lot of redundant ways of representing that data here. This picture has a very low data ink ratio. I won't go through that same exercise here, but you can see that by now you should see that the for three-dimensional bar charts, that number will be even lower. It's a lot of redundant information. There's also a lot of metadata that you can potentially get rid of in your visualization. I imagine a lot of people have created a graph that looks similar to this. This is a scatter diagram with a trend line going through it. I created these in the second grade with graph paper and a ruler, doing some science experiments. The only data ink in here are the points, the data points that are surrounding the trend line. That's the data, and that's the data ink. Everything else is not. So this right now has a very low data ink ratio, just a little bit of data ink and a lot of ink. These grid lines, for example, are not data. They are metadata, and we can get rid of some of them. And notice when I get rid of them, how the data itself jumps out. I can see that those data points a lot more clearly. I could even lighten them, and it jumps out even more. This is what spreadsheet manufacturers figured out by the time they got to version 2. In version 1 of most spreadsheets for Windows, those lines between the grids, they were black. By the time version 2 came out, they were gray, they were light gray, because spreadsheet manufacturers recognized that the lines between the cells are metadata. It's the numbers in the cells that are the data, and those should jump out. Those should be more important. In this case, I don't even know if we need those grid lines. We can get rid of them entirely. I don't think it's lost anything in terms of information, and it's got a lot less ink, and I can see the data even more clearly now. So now I've got a much higher data ink ratio, and the data jumps out at me more. But I can go further than this. Do I really need those borders on the top and right? Do I really need all the numbers on the X and Y axis? The less distractions I have, the more the data jumps out at me. And each time I do this, I stop and I ask myself, is the graph better or is it worse? If it's not worse, leave it. All things being equal, let's get rid of that non-data ink. If it is worse, then maybe we ought to put it back. It's an iterative process. So for example, this trend line is not data, it's metadata. If I get rid of it, I think it's better with it. I think it adds some value, this trend line. So that's an iterative process. I erase and stop and ask myself, does it make it better, does it make it worse? Maybe I'll put something back. Here's a real world example. This is from Linus Pauling. I'm a great admirer of Linus Pauling because I actually have a degree in biochemistry, and Pauling is the only man to earn a Nobel Prize in what? Anyone? He's a Nobel Prize in chemistry and peace. This one, he was smart enough to not put these grid lines in his visualization. But he did replace some of these little plus signs, and I would argue those are not necessary. That the data is just as clear, and the data itself jumps out more without them. This is the atomic volume of each element versus its atomic number. And he has added these lines, these curved lines that group together the rows in the periodic table, which I remember from my college days is the number of electron shells, I think is what that is. Anyway, there is some significant information in the fact that these are all the same row. And if I remove those trend lines, it becomes much less useful. So that metadata, I think, is very useful. I would put that back, and I would also label them to show which row we're talking about by putting the label and the atomic number of the first element in that row, the one with only one electron in it. Remember this graph? This was the train schedule. This has a problem that has a couple of problems, but it could benefit from some redundant data. In this case, what happens if a train is in transit at 6 a.m.? This train right here, for example, if I want to traverse this entire line, my eyes have to go all the way over to the left and look over here and continue it. It's kind of hard. It's no longer intuitive to me. I can resolve this, though, by taking the first half of the graph and repeating it over here on the right, and then I don't have to go through that. So this is a much lower data ink ratio, the one on the bottom does, but it's still easier to read. So sometimes you need to reduce your data ink ratio. That's not a hard and fast rule. We reduce it within reason. We could probably offset that by removing some of those grid lines, as I'm sure a few of you have thought of. So here's some principles from this last section here. Number one, think about the data. What is the data? What are you trying to show? That's really what you ought to be focusing on, and get your users to look at that. And you can do so by thinking about this concept of a data ink ratio. What's data? What's not data? What's non-data ink? What's redundant data ink? And this, just be aware, this is an iterative process. This is probably the biggest benefit I had directly from reading Tufte's work. I've had a lot of applications I've written that people were doing things in Excel and they wanted to replace it with a web app or something like that. But they wanted to look just like Excel. Put all these lines in here. And I started to put the lines in. I said, you know what? Take a look at this. Maybe this looks a little better to you without all these lines. Maybe it's a little bit less cluttered. And I'd get pushback. They said, but yeah, but our users love Excel. well, what if we had really light lines? What if you could barely see them? Then they could see the data a lot more clearly. Vibrations are less of a problem today than they were before. Vibrations refer to this kind of patterns that you see. Before we had cheap color printers, people would print out different series with different patterns. And this is some people look at this, they get a seizure. I'm not making this up. This is there's actually something called the moiré effect, which if you stare at something with a tight pattern like that, it looks like it's moving. And it becomes very distracting. So graphs like this become almost unreadable to people. Or even like this. I look at this thing here and I see that there's, down at the bottom here, I've got this series at the bottom, it's diagonal lines. I've got to look up at the legend here and I see, okay, diagonal lines, that's what, unfinished oils. Oh no, wait, that's from the diagonal from the bottom, left, top, right. I need this one, crude oil. And it's a problem. First of all, I don't like legends. Legends, I understand there's sometimes when it's necessary, but generally you're forcing your user to look up and then look down again. And that's a distracting to the user. Oops. Here's another example here. These are percentage of articles during the 1972 presidential election shown by patterns. Again, it's really difficult for me to look at this and see, okay, these diagonal lines refer to inflation here. These are diagonal lines as well in the same direction. They just happen to be more narrow. Eventually, you run out of patterns to use. A much better way is something like this. First, you could use colors. Colors do have a disadvantage in that you may have users that are colorblind, and you have to be sensitive to that. Depends upon who your audience is. But here I've just simply labeled these bars. No use need for a legend at all. So I could print this in black and white, and it would still work. All right, chart junk and ducks. These are essentially the same thing. These are things that a lot of people like to add to their visualizations, but they don't provide any value at all. They're just there to create some buzz around your visualization. They're called ducks because there's a building in Flanders, New York, which I have a picture of here, that's shaped like a duck for no other reason than that people will be driving down the street and say, hey, look, there's a building that's shaped like a duck. Let's go check it out. It works in the short term, but it doesn't get anybody to come back. It doesn't add to the functionality of that building at all. It's just, let's go check out the duck building so we can say we've seen it once. Well, visualizations sometimes have cute little decorations that don't provide any value at all. And this one here, I don't know the source of this one, but it's they've curved these bars simply to represent the declining aspect of this graph, and it's confusing. First of all, I don't know whether to look at the left edge or the right edge. It just makes it less usable for this chart. Something here that has a lot of clutter. They've added too many colors. They're using colors to represent numeric data, even more so here. Remember I showed you the chart earlier that was census data, and I went from light red to dark red? It worked. It worked really well. Now if I want to go from different numeric ranges, I have to look at green versus dark purple or green versus yellow to see these numbers. I constantly have to look back and forth to these charts. It just doesn't work. And this... this is a real thing. This is those are tough, these words. Perhaps the worst visualization ever created, I think it was the exact quote. This is from an educational journal. What it's showing is the number of, I need to refresh my memory here. It's the, for 5 different years, it's the percentage of students that are under 25 years old and the percentage of students that are over 25 years old. So there's really only 5 pieces of data in here. It's the percentage for each year, right? I mean, because this number up here, this is the percentage that are over 25. How long would you have to look at this graph before you would realize that the number here at the top and the number at the bottom add up to 100% every time? I mean, I know that's the case, and I still look at it, and I can't see how that's true. So they've taken these 5 points of data. I guess you could argue there are 10. And they're using five different colors and three-dimensional, and it's just crazy stuff. It's not intuitive at all. They've also rounded it. I don't think there's any reason. I don't think they took measurements for each month of the year. But they just added these decorations. I think for this particular example, a better way of representing this data is just like that. Sometimes the numbers are better. Sometimes visualizations just get in the way. Here's something clever you can do to reduce your data ink ratio. Oops, increase your data ink ratio. Is you can use some of your data points as some of your metadata, what you typically would use as metadata. A clever desk sergeant during World War I was asked to create a graph of the number of troops that were deployed to France each month. And he did so, but rather than just using points, he has the division number of each division that was deployed. So if you look for a given month, you can not only see how tall the bar is, but you can actually see which individual divisions were deployed during that month. In this case, we have no values along the x-axis. Usually we have values every x number of units, and we just have to interpolate. Here, the points themselves are the x values. And we just project those from the x-axis up to our points. So we've increased the data ink ratio, but haven't lost any information at all. In this example, the y-axis, instead of being equally spaced increments, which is what we're used to, they simply put the y value there. It's a little bit more ink here, but there's actually more data ink. The only time they couldn't do that is right down near the bottom where the numbers were so close together that now you have to interpolate between 0.2 and 0.4. All right, data density is another topic that it used to be easier to talk about data density when we printed things out, because when we measure data density, technically we should be the number of pieces of data divided by the area of a data graphic. And although we can still on screen think about the number of pieces of data, we really don't know the area because we don't know if it's going to be printed on a piece of paper that's this big or paper this big. But the important thing about data density is that we can recognize what's low, what's very dense data versus what's very low density data. There is a kind of a lot of people are afraid to pack too much information into a visualization. They're worried that they're going to overwhelm their users. And I don't think that's a valid concern. I think people can see a lot of data very quickly. As long as it's presented well, it's okay to put a lot of things. Certainly that census data that we saw there that had over 3,000 data points in it, even in the aggregation, people could see that because they could see patterns in it. But you can certainly see this is a very low data density. This is the percentage of students that are, the percentage of adults who are either in college or university, that's this bar right here, or that are in adult education, this bar here. This bar over here actually is just the sum of the other two, so it doesn't really add much value. There's really only a couple pieces of data in here, an X and a Y for those two other bars, and a lot of wasted space here. So this has when it was originally printed out, it was a government document, had about 0.15 data entries per square inch. And that number isn't really important, except that you can recognize that this is a much more dense document with quite a few lines of it. This is 181 numbers per square inch when it was printed out. And this is the weather every single day of the year in New York City. We have the high and low temperature. We have the average high and low temperature around that. We have the relative humidity every day. We have the high and low precipitation. And we've got some annual information up in the corner. There's a lot of information in this graphic, but it isn't overwhelming. It's presented well. It's organized well, and we can see, oh, look, it's hotter in the summertime than it is in the wintertime. Or you can see for this particular year how much volatility there was. Looks like it was a pretty rainy spring. Here's even more data. This is actually, each one of these little dots represents a measurement of sunlight. This is every hour of every day for an entire year, how much sunlight was there. And you can see the curved line is actually sunrise on top and sunset on the bottom. So There's no sunshine at night, obviously, but during the daytime, there's usually sunshine. There's a lot more of it in the summertime. The days are longer. You can see when the cloudy days were, because there's not a lot of sun. You can see when there was cloudy in the morning, and so on. There's tons of pieces of information. In fact, there's about 1,000 numbers per square inch in this. But it's readable. We can see it. Small multiples are a way of representing an extra dimension in your graph. This is a big thing nowadays. A lot of the visualization tools you're seeing now, and as I said, this isn't really a tools talk. This is more of a guidance talk. But a lot of tools are using animations to represent that extra dimension. So you can see things change over time. But you don't need fancy tools to do this. You can just simply repeat a graph multiple times with just one variable changed, and that becomes your extra dimension. For example, right here, here's a graph that was created by hand. It shows the age of fish caught in northern European streams. And you can see in 1908, there was a look like the average age of the fish was around 5 or 6 years. Certainly, there was a big peak around 4 years. And as time went on, from 1908 to 1913, that peak moved to the right, indicating that fish were getting older. The fish that fishermen were catching were getting older, even though they seem to be catching more fish. That graph seems to be a little bit higher. And that's an indication that these streams are not being overfished. So we've added that extra dimension simply by repeating it multiple times. Here's a company that really specializes in lots of data, presenting a lot of data to the users. This is Consumer Reports. And this is a lot of pieces of information, but with about 60 seconds of explanation, I think you'll understand it. Every one of these rectangles represents a make and model of a car. And each rectangle is divided into six columns. Each column is a model year and about 15 rows. And each row represents a potential problem area of an automobile, like the brakes or the transmission or the rust, interior rust or exterior rust. And for each one of these intersections of a model year for a make model of a car and a potential trouble area, we have a circle. A completely filled in circle means this is a problem with that car. If the brakes fail a lot on that car, or it rusts out a lot, a completely not filled in circle means this is good. This owners of this car have almost never have that problem. And then there are varying levels. It could be partially filled in. The more black, the bigger a problem it is. So if you know that, then you can just compare. You can look and say, boy, it sure looks like this Plymouth Velare has a lot more dark circles than this Mercedes-Benz. It looks like that Mercedes-Benz is a lot more reliable car. There's a lot less trouble for it. Mercedes-Benz tends to cost a lot more than the Plymouth Velare did, and they do have a line down here for cost. It's the only dark area for the Mercedes. But because they basically added an extra dimension to it, the cars. So you're looking at this along several dimensions. Trouble spots, make and model of car, model year, and the different models to compare side by side. And the last section I want to talk about here is the graphs that Edward Tufte came up with himself. He came up with one that's really been widely adopted. That's the spark line. And one that I've seen it, but I don't really see it that often in the wild. That's the slope graph. The spark line is, we see this all over the place. Let's see a lot in financial magazines or financial newspapers and magazines. It's a very compact way of showing data series over time, or really any dimension. We see with financial information, a lot of times we'll see like stock prices or currency prices, as in this case, over time. And rather than showing an entire x-axis or y-axis with numbers to extrapolate or interpolate between, what this will show you typically is just a couple of numbers, maybe the beginning number or the ending number, just to give it context so you know where you are, maybe the high or the low, identifying just those. And the beauty of this is that you can actually take this graph and either stack it on top with other similar graphs and put a lot of them together so you can do comparisons between the volatility of all these currencies. Oh, I'm sorry, this isn't currency, this is gross domestic product. Or you can actually include it directly in text, in a paragraph. Some people believe that you shouldn't mix text and visualizations together, that's nonsense. In the middle of your paragraph, if you want to talk about the fact that you have a spark line or that this stock price is very volatile, then in parentheses, you can actually include a spark line. And that can be a very effective way of doing things. In Excel now, they have the ability to add a spark line to the end inside of a cell. So you could have a row of financial data and then a row of just the spark line showing that financial data very quickly. Here's another example. There's some exchange rates. I like this one here because this was from showing the measurements, glucose measurements. A doctor might take glucose measurements over time, and the ending value is shown here. We can label that ending value to make it more clear. We can show what normal rates are, normal levels of glucose are, to show that there are times when this patient's glucose is abnormally high or abnormally low. There's just a lot of information packed into a small area with this graph. And this is really nice if a hospital chart contains something like this. The doctor could look at it very quickly without having to read a lot of information to see what measurements have been taken about a patient and what which ones you should be concerned about because they're outside of the normal range. Very quickly, you can get a lot of information here. Slope graphs, this is essentially a line graph with just 2 points, and it's a bunch of line graphs that are compared together. So you can see the comparison between the changes, how things have changed, as opposed relative to one another. I haven't seen this a lot in the wild, and I actually gave this talk a few months ago, and somebody emailed me an example I thought was a pretty good one here. This is from the Atlantic, and this is two surveys taken 9 years apart showing public confidence in a bunch of public institutions, such as the military, the police, the church, medical system. And you can see in most of these areas, public confidence has actually gone down, and some of it had gone significantly down. A few of it had gone up. So over that decade, confidence in churches had gone up. Confidence in the medical system had gone up slightly, but confidence in Congress, for example, had gone way down. Congress took a big hit. The presidency took a big hit during that decade. So there's some information you can see very quickly in here. I haven't seen a lot of use of slope charts in the past, but I thought this was a very good one. So I'm getting near the end here. And there are so here's some of the takeaways. Keep your data simple and maintain graphical integrity. Don't lie with your data. Think about what you're trying to show and keep that lie factor in mind. Keep the proportions the same for your data as they are for your visualization. Think about the data ink ratio. Maximize that value within reason. That's an iterative process. Start looking at when you hit next finish, stop for a second and look back and say, do I have too much metadata? Do I have redundant data here? What's in here? Avoid extraneous stuff. We call them chart junk. We call them ducks. Just avoid them. They really don't help your graphic at all. Sometimes you can use multifunctioning graphic elements. That's not always possible, but it's a clever way of doing things sometimes. Avoid legends. Labeling data directly is much better. Also, some people say don't mix, don't put text inside of your visualization. Don't put text in your graph. Nonsense. Put text in your graph. It helps the graph. Put text in there. If it helps your text, put a graph in there. As long as it's effective. Consider data density. Don't be afraid to put a lot of data into your visualizations. People can handle it as long as it's presented well. And then common access for comparison is a great tool for providing business intelligence. Let's come back to this graphic here. This is Charles Menard's representation of Napoleon's advance on retreat from Moscow. Menard could have presented this a different way. He could have done whatever the 19th century equivalent of next finish is. He could have dressed it up using his obvious artistic skills. But if we look at it this way, we don't really see a lot of information, certainly not in the way that he chose to represent it. And that's what I want you to do. I want you to take a step back, and I want you to think about how you're representing the data. So whatever tool you're using, after you've created your visualization, Ask yourself, do I need all of that metadata? Can I get rid of some of it and not lose any information? Can I get rid of some redundant data? Can I clean this up and make it a little bit easier for my users to see? If I've cleaned it up, not only does the data jump out at me, but I've got room to add another series. And once I've added another series, then my users can start to look at this in a new way. They can start to compare the series, see correlations between them, coming up with reasonable explanations as to why those correlations exist. That's knowledge. That's information. That's power. Your users will thank you. My name is David Giard, and I thank you.